From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Can Bannon topple the Republican ruling class? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. The GOP controls the White House and both houses of Congress, but that's not stopping former Trump aide Steve Bannon from fomenting a revolution.
We are declaring war on the Republican establishment. It's a new game in town. We're going to cut off the oxygen to Mitch McConnell.
McConnell's the Senate Republican leader Bannon blames for unkept promises, especially the vow to repeal and replace Obamacare. Bannon's war starts with Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, who's extreme enough to make establishment Republicans cringe. We'll hear what might be in store for the grand old party with George W. Bush getting into the act. Later on today's Talking Point, neutralizing a white nationalist on a university campus. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Mormon Alney back with To the Point. Donald Trump appealed to the frustrated base of the Republican Party. Steve Bannon rode Trump's train to the White House. Now Bannon's out on his own, fomenting revolution against the GOP establishment, especially leadership in the Senate. Where's President Trump as the battle lines are being drawn? Today's Talking Point, white nationalist Richard Spencer was allowed a forum yesterday at the University of Florida, despite concerns about public safety. But Spencer's message did not get through, even though there was no violence. We'll hear how that happened. First is news update. In a party-line vote, except for Rand Paul of Kentucky, Senate Republicans passed a framework for a budget last night. But a detailed spending plan will have to come later. The objective was to protect a massive proposed tax cuts from a Democratic filibuster. Thomas Kaplan covers Congress for the New York Times. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this appears to be a budget vote, but it's really a device to do other things.
That's exactly right. While this is called a budget, it really isn't about budgeting at all. The budgeting part of this is pretty much meaningless. It doesn't carry the force of law. What this is all about is paving the way for a tax overhaul.
So what about the tax overhaul? What do we know about that?
Well, this is what's happening now is basically the same strategy that Republicans in Congress used in their attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They are paving the way to be able to pass a tax bill that they could do with only Republican votes that would not be subject to a Democratic filibuster in the Senate. But we don't know exactly what the contents of that tax bill will be. That's still to come.
What about the House? Would they have to go along too?
Well, that's the next piece here. So the House already adopted its own budget earlier this month. They have now indicated they plan to take up the Senate budget as early as next week and pass that, which would speed things up rather than having the House and Senate negotiate sort of to merge their two plans. If the House just takes up what passed the Senate, that sort of skips that step. So it looks like the House will do that, and then it's on to tax reform after that.
So the question then is there enough in this framework of the budget to turn off sufficient House members that it doesn't pass there?
Yeah, and that's going to be the question over the next couple days. Now, there were some key differences between what the two chambers did. One thing in the House was that Republicans there pushed for spending cuts as part of their budget, instructing House committees to come up with at least around $200 billion worth of savings. That's not part of the Senate plan, so fiscal conservatives in the House will have to live with letting go of that. But right now, it looks like the enthusiasm for tax reform may outweigh those concerns, and House members will be willing to vote for the Senate plan as early as next week.
This not only allows that, but it also allows opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil exploration.
So this hasn't gotten much attention, but it's a long-running issue and could be a big fight in the coming months. There's language in the Senate-passed budget, along with laying the groundwork for a tax overhaul. It also lays the groundwork for legislation that could be part of that tax overhaul that would open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to drilling, and that could pass as part of a tax bill, again, with only Republican votes. That legislation still is to come, but this lays the groundwork for that to happen, and we'll see. There'll be certainly efforts there on both sides to lobby senators which way to vote on that, but this would allow that to pass with 50 votes as part of a tax bill.
Tax reform really means tax cuts. Would the taxes from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge help to make up for that? Is that what it's about?
Well, the scale is quite different. So the way the budget is drawn up, the Senate Energy Committee would have to come up with legislation, presumably to allow drilling, that would generate at least $1 billion in revenue. On the flip side, the tax plan could cost as much as $1.5 trillion over a decade. So they will be packaged together in the same bill, but I think the idea is more that doing it this way would allow a drilling measure to pass with only 50 votes in the Senate rather than the 60 votes you typically would need.
$1.5 trillion in tax cuts. What about the deficit?
Well, that's something that's not getting quite so much discussion from Republicans these days. I talked to a few weeks ago, a leading conservative House member who noted that during the Obama administration, talking about the debt and deficit was, a prime subject for Republicans, and it's not so much anymore. But there's a lot of enthusiasm among Republicans to do a tax overhaul with the hope that that will generate economic growth and offset the cost of doing the tax overhaul. So certainly the enthusiasm for taxes is taking precedence at this point.
Okay. Then the question of enthusiasm devolves to who gets a tax cut and who gets a tax increase. Since it's called reform, it's also has increases for some people. We'll find out what all that means as time goes on. It's great to have you. Thanks for the basics.
Thank you.
Thomas Kaplan with the New York Times. In a moment, can Bannon topple the GOP ruling class? This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Republicans can't afford to lose one seat in the U.S. Senate, so there are signs that the party establishment is getting behind the disgraced former judge Roy Moore to replace Jeff Sessions of Alabama in the Senate. Here's Moore, who's facing a liberal Democrat in the reddest of red states in December. This is a montage of things that he has had to say through the years.
Crime, corruption, immorality, abortion, sodomy, sexual perversion sweep our land.
Now we got blacks and whites fighting, reds and yellows fighting.
Homosexual conduct should be illegal today. That's a yes or no question.
Homosexual conduct
should be
illegal. Yes.
Should be illegal.
Yes. Yes.
We've got to recognize that we've been separated by something that separation of church and state doesn't stand for. It doesn't separate us from God. Nothing can separate us from God.
Nash Jenkins is Washington correspondent for Time magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Warren. Thank you for having me.
So just based on that comment we just heard, remind our listeners that this is the man who put the Ten Commandments in a big piece of cement in the Supreme Court building in Alabama, even though the Supreme Court told him not to.
Yeah, well, here's a man who believes fundamentally that our Constitution and the legal system surrounding it is predicated on God, right? And no one's going to tell him otherwise. So when he was first elected Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, he did what you just said. He put a large 5,000-pound granite monument to the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of the Alabama State Courthouse. He faced lawsuits, and he said, I'm not taking it down. So he was removed from office. But if it gives you any idea of his political clout in Alabama, he was reelected in 2012, and he was removed again last year, this time for ordering judges in the state not to issue same-sex marriage licenses, even after the Supreme Court ruled doing so unconstitutional. So you have an idea of the kind of guy we're working with here.
Okay, so now he is a candidate for the U.S. Senate. It's a runoff election. He's got a Democrat that he is facing. You just interviewed Judge Moore fairly recently. What did he tell you?
Well, you know, here's a guy, like I said, whose belief in the spiritual foundation of our country, as he puts it, is under attack. And his primary objective in coming to the Senate, and it does look like he is going to win, is, quote-unquote, restoring the country to that. You know, I asked him what one of his major goals as senator would be, and he said, you know, I want to work to impeach the five Supreme Court justices who voted to affirm the constitutionality of same-sex marriage. You know, he very much has a one-track mind. He speaks in terms of the Constitution and its spiritual foundation, and he wants a larger stage on which he can act his ideas.
And why do you say he's going to win in Alabama?
I say he's going to win in Alabama because I'll give you two reasons. One, it's a deeply crimson state. I don't have the exact percentage off the top of my head, but it went for Trump by a huge margin in 2016. You know, secondly, Alabama is a state. It's one of the many states in the U.S. where the electorate is deeply frustrated with the Republican establishment. So while Moore, brands himself as a spiritual constitutionalist, many people are eyeing the big picture. Here's a guy who's going to come to the Senate, represent what we want, not kowtow to the forces of the establishment. And that's really the more responsible way to look at this election. It's not so much about putting a man of God in office as it is electing someone who is going to stand up to the Mitch McConnells, to the Paul Ryans.
Okay, and that's exactly where we get Steve Bannon into the act. He did the same thing, of course, with President Trump. Now he has jumped onto Moore's campaign to make Alabama's election the first battleground in what he calls intra-party warfare. Here he is explaining himself to Sean Hannity on Fox News.
Republicans are weak and pathetic, and they're lacking in identity.
They have total contempt for the base. That's what you saw in Alabama. In Alabama, where they came in with Luther Strange with $32 million to destroy Judge Moore, you saw what the base thought of them, right? The base totally rejected
them.
These people have no respect for the working men and women. There's a coalition coming together that's going to challenge every Republican incumbent except for Ted Cruz, whether it's Utah, Wyoming.
Pat Duggins is news director of Alabama Public Radio. Before we get to Ted Cruz in Texas, tell us more about Alabama and Luther Strange. What happened there?
Well, I think it was a very small voter turnout. And the one thing that Roy Moore really does have in common with Donald Trump is he has a very, very, very devoted following. So as long as he keeps the base, you know, fed with red meat, they're going to show up and they're going to vote. That's why it's entirely possible that the December vote is going to go toward Roy Moore. But the Democrats are still holding out hope that, you know, Doug Jones may be able to pull it out.
Okay, tell us about Doug Jones.
Well, Doug Jones, if you go by his resume, the Democrats are painting him kind of like the Masked Avenger. I mean, not only did he prosecute two members of the Ku Klux Klan for the 1963 16th Street Baptist Church bombings, he also got Eric Rudolph for the 1996 Olympic Park bombing up in Atlanta. So he's just, you know, the race is going. It's almost like old school Alabama versus new school Alabama. You've got Roy Moore, who's like one of those politicians who in Alabama like to out-Bible each other. And then you've got Doug Jones, who in a campaign speech said he's tired of Alabama being an embarrassment and he wants to change that. So it's just it depends on who shows up on Election Day.
On the other hand, Jones is a Democrat and he has some positions that don't go over too well in that deeply red state.
Well, unfortunately, no. He did picture himself in front of a Planned Parenthood. And, you know, because of that, there are people that I've spoken to who say that they know people in church, for example, who say, oh, he's in favor of abortion. We're not going to vote for him, that sort of thing. And the fact that he did come out and say the embarrassment word regarding Alabama. I mean, Roy Moore's group immediately jumped on that. But the thing about it is, there are more than a few Alabama. See, I'm not from Alabama. I'm an Air Force kid. I'm from D.C., you know, lived in Florida for a long time. That's where I covered the space program for NPR. But the point is, there are more than a few Alabamians who've come up to me over the years and say that they're tired of being on the wrong side of history. So if enough of these people, and right now they're wondering if enough people turn out, for example, in Birmingham, it really seems to be like an urban versus rural issue. If enough people show up in Birmingham in the middle of December to vote for Doug Jones, he might be able to do it. Otherwise, Roy Moore is going to go to Washington.
Is there a big black vote in Birmingham?
Well, yes, and that's mostly the inner part of town, and then you've got a lot of the suburbs around the outside. There was a lot of a white flight in the 1960s following the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. But right now, if you take a look at the polls, the oldest poll, by that I mean like 3 days ago, was by Fox News, and that had 42% split. In other words, 42% for Moore, 42% for Jones. Now, for a Democrat in Alabama to come that close in the polls and to winning a U.S. Senate seat, it ranks right up there with the Second Coming. Nobody has done that well this recently. So that's why at least some of the Democrats, they feel as though they've got a chance. They're actually reaching out to moderate Republicans, and some moderate Republicans are reaching back. And again, it's just, you know, who shows up on Election Day?
Pat Duggins, immigrant from Washington, D.C., now news director at Alabama Public Radio. Nash Jenkins, back to you with time. I take it that Mr. Moore, former Judge Moore, told you that it's illegal not to stand for the national anthem?
He did say that. He said a lot of things. You know, he's an interesting guy in that he's very deeply well-read and has the ability to rattle off entire passages of not only the Constitution, but arcane legal documents, Blackstone's commentaries, and apply them to what he believes. He was making a point about Dwight Eisenhower's decision to add the words "under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance, and I asked him if he was making a comment about the NFL taking a knee controversy, and he said, yeah, don't you know that it's illegal for them to do that? And I said, honestly, no, I did not. And he proceeded to refer to a section of the U.S. Code that, in other words, did not make it illegal. He was choosing to apply it as such. But yeah, that's what he said.
Is he now a soldier in Bannon's revolution? Does he see himself that way?
He does not see himself that way, but for this story, I spoke to a number of people close to Bannon, and they made it clear that Moore is precisely the sort of candidate they want to back. As Bannon's people see 2018, they see it as the real war. Donald Trump coming to the White House was not a victory. It was a chance to win, a chance to fight for victory. In order for Trump to quote-unquote drain the swamp and make America great again, they have to bulldoze the political establishment. So, you know, Moore represents that anti-establishment current that they see as having real political potential.
Are they for anything?
Well, yes, but you're thinking of it in the wrong terms. It's not so much about what they're for as it is, you know, what they're against. It's an amorphous movement. You know, you have these evangelical conservatives like Moore. You have the small government libertarians like Rand Paul. You have the pro-border security economic nationalists like Bannon himself. And Bannon has been quite clever. He sees the opportunity to galvanize this loose coalition and carry the momentum all the way to Washington.
But it sounds like it's virtually to stop anything from happening, although that's already going on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the reason this movement has momentum a year after Trump's victory, you know, Congress hasn't been able to do much. You know, for the first time in a decade, the Republicans control both houses of Congress and the White House, and yet look at their track record. Two attempts at repealing Obamacare have failed. They've seen the president working with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, two Republican boogeymen, to strike a deal on immigration. Their last real hope is tax reform, and while they did pass a budget last night, as you discussed earlier, it remains to be seen that that's going to get done before the end of the year.
Well, now here's something very interesting. That is the question of where President Trump stands. We heard that Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, is a major target of Mr. Bannon. But this week, the Senate leader and the chief executive made like political allies.
My relationship with this gentleman is outstanding, has been outstanding.
I want to underscore what the president said. We have the same agenda.
So, Pat Duggins, back to you at Alabama Public Radio. When President Trump supported Luther Strange against Judge Moore, he lost big. What does this mean in the what we just heard, an alliance, at least verbally, between the president and the Senate Majority Leader?
Well, when Mr. Trump came down, he said, well, I'm here for Luther Strange, but if Moore does okay, I'll endorse him too. So it's kind of like, you know, it was very lukewarm. Now, Alabama still loves Trump. I mean, the latest numbers that I show was about a 51% approval rate for the president. But, you know, it just, you know, it gets back to, you know, what we're talking about earlier about, like, you know, can we get enough people who are, you know, pro-Jones to show up at the polls in December, as opposed to the very, all right, when you have a small group of people who are showing up on Election Day, usually they're people who are mad or they're fanatical. And so that would seem to lean toward Roy Moore. If enough people are upset about Alabama's current, you know, self-perception of, like, you know, being a pariah state, that sort of thing, then enough people show up, then it could be Doug Jones. It's this close, half and half, as far as, like, you know, the polls are concerned. That's what's giving everybody on the Jones ticket at least some hope that it might go their way. Although, if you know, if it doesn't, then Roy Moore winds up getting it.
Okay, election coming up in early December. Melanie Watson is with us, and she's important because she's a lifelong Republican. But in fact, even though she is such a thing and has been in a lot of campaigns, she now, although she lives in Dallas, is encouraging people to contribute to the Democrat, Doug Jones. Melanie Watson, welcome to you.
Hi, Warren.
Why are you doing that?
Well, the last 24 hours, I was asking myself the same question. No, the reason that I'm doing that is because of the country over party issue. There are certain variables that shouldn't be partisan. And the gentleman before me was speaking about, you know, what's important to Trumpians. And I say Trumpians. I mean, I'm a Republican. I just don't remember Trump-like people coming to any of our meetings or doing the hard lifting, knocking on doors. Maybe they were there, but I don't remember people being so angry. And but I ask them, why do you like Trump? And they say, freedom. And I say, really? Okay, pure unadulterated freedom? How does that work if you're being forced to stand up? You know? And they say, oh, don't help that Jones guy in Alabama. He's pro-abortion. Yet they're okay with him wanting to, saying that he wants to hang homosexuals. How does that compute?
You mean they're okay with Roy Moore saying that?
They're okay with Roy voting for him, knowing that he's a premeditated murderer planner, you know? I mean, he wants to murder people, a group of people. And I don't understand being pro-life and being pro-Roy Moore. It doesn't compute.
Are you also go ahead, excuse me.
That's it. There's just a ton of things. The whole tax cut thing. I mean, it looks like it's going to work out to be $40 for a middle class family. How nice of them. How nice of Trump, you know? And so the reason I'm doing this is because I believe that Bannon is a cancer in our party. I believe that if we continue with these outliers, the United States citizens are going to outlie the Republican Party. And, you know, principle accounts for something. George Bush 41 had this saying, I need a friend a whole lot more than I need an enemy. And Barbara Bush would get frustrated with him because she thought he was too quick to resolve issues.
But okay, I'm going to interrupt you just in the interest of time. We hear the music. We've got to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll hear something from 41's son, Melanie Watson, again in Dallas. Back in a moment with To the Point on our talking point. A white nationalist is allowed to speak on a university campus, but his message is neutralized. We'll hear about that.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, hearing today that Republicans are angry about different things. Some of them, and Steve Bannon is trying to take advantage of this, are angry at the establishment of the party. Melanie Watson, who's a member of the establishment party, is angry at Bannon and perhaps also at President Trump. Now, as open warfare seems about to break out, another former president broke 10 years of silence yesterday. Here's George W. Bush slamming Trumpism without mentioning his successor by name.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism. We've seen the return of isolationist sentiments, forgetting that American security is directly threatened by the chaos and despair of distant places.
So, Melanie Watson, back to you, our lifelong Republican who's actually supporting Mr. Jones in Alabama. Is this the kind of Republicanism you want to hear?
Oh, yes, it is. It made me nostalgic. Every president, Democrat or Republican, that we've had in my lifetime has followed a set of norms. For example, I don't recall hearing that any did interviews for U.S. attorneys from law firms. They followed a set of norms. The office was sacred. They felt like they represented everybody, even the people that didn't like them. It's just a very, very different climate. And I believe that, you know, if some of the Republicans that have, you know, followed Trump, if they get reelected, maybe it's annoying. If Moore gets elected, it's a disaster, in my opinion. And that's why I am trying to help them out.
Let me introduce another guest, Jeet Heer. He is a senior editor at The New Republic. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
You have indicated that even as the Republican Party appears to be falling apart and arguing with within itself, that in fact it's not going to crack up. People are always predicting that, but it actually gets stronger. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, this current issue with Roy Moore falls into a pattern that has been there since at least 40 or 50 years, which is that you have a kind of sort of populist rebellion and you have the establishment, and there's sort of tension, and then eventually the establishment sort of tries to absorb the populist rebellion and falls in line. So you saw that with Goldwater, with Reagan, with more recently the Tea Party. And so I don't think that the and it's very clear now that, like, you know, Roy Moore is not just that he won the nomination, but he is, very reputable Republicans are now endorsing him.
Which ones?
Well, I believe Rand Paul and is one, and Mike Lee was another. So I sort of feel like it's, you know, they're going to come around to him. Maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the RNC sort of on board with Moore now?
Let me go back to Nash Jenkins with the Time magazine. What about the Republican National Committee? Are they getting behind Judge Moore?
Yeah, well, Jeet is correct in saying that they're slowly but surely warming up to him. I mean, you look at the list. I can even add to that list. Mark Meadows, the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, he's backed Moore. I think it's going to be inevitable that if Doug Jones begins to look like a serious contender, which isn't out of the question, the RNC is going to have no choice. Because, you know, the Republicans have the majority in the Senate, but it's a slim majority. It's a slim majority, and the fights they need to fight, they're going to be paying attention to.
Jed, here, back to you with the New Republic. When you talk Rod Paul and Mike Lee and the chair of the Freedom Caucus, you're talking about some pretty conservative Republicans. What about those who are thought of as the establishment, pardon me, taking a more moderate view than the others? Are they going to be dragged along, too?
If history is any guide, yeah, I think that they will. Precisely because they only have a narrow majority in the Senate. And also just the sheer power of negative partisanship. I mean, I think that's the great dynamic that's sort of governing America, that people don't really know what they like, but they know what they hate. And you can rally enough people. And I think this is sort of, you know, I hate to credit Steve Bannon with anything, but I think he has picked up on this fact and is aware that he can sort of get this coalition of outliers together and win some victories because he can constantly emphasize that it's either us or it's Hillary Clinton. It's either us or it's Doug Jones. It's either us or the Democrats. So I think negative partisanship is going to unite the Republicans.
Melanie Watson, let me go back to you, our lifelong Republican. Does this sound like your worst nightmare?
Well, yes, sir. Indeed, it does. It does sound that way. I think what is going to happen if the Republicans start backing people like Moore, and by the way, Mike Lee is dead to me as officially today for endorsing that guy. I think what's going to happen is the moderates, which is like 60% of the country, is going to vote Democrat. And like I said earlier, they're going to get outliered right out of Congress, and or we are. And maybe that needs to happen, you know, so that we can get back to what's important. Because the other thing, too, I don't know how many people, even especially Republicans, realize Trump has never won a majority vote in his life. He did not win 60% of the Republican Party vote in the primaries. They voted for somebody else, and he didn't win it in the general. So you have a situation where Steve Bannon took this opportunity to hijack a party. It's all based on smoke and mirrors. And so I'm hoping. And the other thing, too, is that I'm hoping moderate Republicans remember we still have a secret ballot. Nobody has to know who you vote for. You don't have to tell people. Just, you know, not to quote Cruz or anything, but vote your conscience. And I'm hoping that that's what happens.
Let me go back to Pat Duggins, again, our news director at Alabama Public Radio. You're the one, I think, who's come the closest, other than Melanie Watson, to saying that there's a possibility that Doug Jones, the Democrat, might win in December. But come on, it's right before Christmas. It's time for shopping. There was a low turnout. You indicated in the primary that Judge Moore won. So how likely, really, is it that he's going to be defeated by a Democrat who stands in front of a sign saying Planned Parenthood?
Well, I always say this, and when I do, my wife gives me the bug zapper look at home. You know, democracies get the leaders that they deserve. Now, if you get people who are mad enough, who like Roy Moore, they're going to show up for him, and he's going to win. If you get enough people, mostly the urbanite Alabamians who are just, you know, tired of all the stereotypes, tired of Roy Moore, you know, riding in on his horse and things, and they're going to vote for Doug Jones, then Jones is going to win. It's a bad time to have an election, although there are a couple of special elections that are being woven into this December general election for Senate to replace a couple of members of the Alabama House and Senate. One would probably send more Republican voters to right around Huntsville, and more would send more Democrats around Montgomery. So there are additional voters going out. So there's no marquee on the ballot. There's no governor. There's no president. So everyone's wondering, oh, is there enough to get people going? But there's dribs and drabs of hope, at least for the Democrats, particularly when you take a look at Doug Jones' fundraising numbers. He's up to $1.3 million, which for a Democrat in Alabama is just unheard of.
You mentioned Birmingham, now Montgomery as well. Are Republicans there as angry as Melanie Watson, our Republican, lifelong Republican from Dallas?
Well, it depends. Some that I've heard of anecdotally are kind of like, oh, you know, Doug Jones, he's in favor of abortion. Let's not vote for him. Oh, he was at Planned Parenthood. Let's not vote for him. But there are also the ones out there that I alluded to earlier who just said that, you know, look, we know about Alabama's civil rights history. We know about the fact that we're a poor state, that we're a sparsely populated state, that people tend to, you know, they like to make fun of Alabama. You tell a joke about an Alabama and you're almost guaranteed a laugh. It's whether or not there are enough of these people who are simply said, look, you know, we don't care the way things are going. We want to simply just put somebody else in there. We don't want Roy Moore. We want Doug Jones. And enough of those people, and probably it's going to be the urban areas, and Birmingham's the biggest urban area. If they show up in December, then there's a glimmer of hope. If not, it's going to be more.
Jeet, here, back to you at the New Republic. Are you surprised that the Democrats are putting money into the fight against Mr. Moore, given what we've heard about the state and given the close nature of the election?
Well, it is surprising just because it is such a red state. But, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, like, Moore is an outlier, and I do think that there are there are a substantial number of Republicans that are very uncomfortable with where their party is going. And I think that it comes at several different directions. I mean, like, you know, like Trump himself could still be popular in Alabama, but like the sort of Trump vote and the Moore vote don't necessarily overlap. There's a lot of Trump voters that are quite secular, and they might not want, you know, someone who's basically a theocrat as their senator.
Nash Jenkins, with time, do you think that Moore would be controllable by the Republican majority, particularly Senator McConnell, who, of course, is a target of Bannon's?
You know, it's funny. I asked Judge Moore that exact question. I said, you know, once you get to the so-called swamp promising to drain it, you know, how are you going to keep your head above water? And he says he's going to defer to his voters because he doesn't want to lose his job, which is a very political answer. You know, I think that ultimately, yeah, he will have to walk the party line. And you know, his views, a lot of them, you know, foundationally they're quite extreme in terms of their, you know, their basis on God. But, you know, ultimately his views aren't that divergent, you know, from you know, those of the Republican conference at large. You know, he's opposed to, you know, abortion. His fight for dismantling same-sex marriage is a pipe dream, so we shouldn't even take that seriously. You know, he supports border control and he supports the Second Amendment. I think the Republican leaders in Congress take offense to the fact that someone like Moore is effectively making his name on their unpopularity, but ultimately I think he'll walk the line if or when he's in office.
Jeet, here, back to you. Will there still be the same line left to walk? You've indicated that you think, historically speaking, the party moves in the direction of those who are the most conservative, the most extreme, if you will.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think one of the sort of interesting lessons that we've learned over the last, you know, several decades is for a lot of people, you know, we talk about, you know, country over party. For a lot of people, it's party over country. They will support the Republican Party no matter what, and they might be uncomfortable with something like a Roy Moore does or some other candidate does, but they'll stick with the party. So I think there's a real possibility that Bannon could pull it off and could, like, you know, bring this sort of motley crew of extremists into the Republican fold.
Okay, we haven't had time and don't have time to talk to the people in other states that Bannon is supporting against Republican incumbents, but he's certainly doing that. Nash Jenkins, with time, do you know what the Senate Democratic leadership is doing? Are they also putting money into Alabama in addition to people like Melanie Watson in order to try to support Doug Jones? We understand his money, his pot of money has gone up a lot.
Yeah, slowly but surely, the Democratic Party is waking up to the battles they're going to have to fight. That said, I don't think you're going to see the DNC putting as much effort into Alabama as they are into states, you know, A, where there's a Democratic incumbent. An example of that would be, you know, Michigan, you know, where the battle is, you know, the battle is easier to win. But yeah, I mean, the Democratic Party is in the throes of an existential crisis. We had a cover story by my colleague Phil Elliott saying exactly that a few weeks ago, essentially arguing that the Democrats, torn by the centrist establishment and this growing fringe of farther to the left, both voters and lawmakers, they really don't know what they're about. So they have a lot of thinking to do between now and November 2018, and I think it's going to be very interesting to watch what they do with the Alabama race and Doug Jones.
Obviously, both parties in the throes of difficulty trying to establish their identity. Melanie Watson, back to you. Once again, you're in Dallas, but you're encouraging people in Alabama to vote for Doug Jones. What do you hear from them? Are you getting a good response?
I have. I've gotten a good response. I've had some very conservative Republicans, they kind of get on to me on Twitter, but, you know, one brought up abortion, but there is no argument on it. I mean, it's a, you know, the gentleman has said repeatedly he thinks a certain group of people should be hanged. And so I'm sorry, the abortion, you know, it just doesn't work, that argument, when you have these two candidates. So I hope that the Democrat will win and that, you know, Steve Bannon, his efforts will, you know, dwindle. I mean, you think about if a blue seat is picked up in Alabama, I mean, just the Fox News polls that they're tied made me excited yesterday. So, yes, he can win there.
How many Twitter followers do you have?
Oh, I don't know. A little over 10,000, I think.
Okay.
10 or 12,000.
All right. So you're reaching a large group then.
I have 6,000 bots blocked from the election.
Okay. Well, that's a subject for another program, and we'll take it up when the time comes. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Melanie Watson, again, lifelong Republican living in Dallas. Thanks to you. Thanks to Jeet Heer, the senior editor at The New Republic. Pat Duggins, news director at Alabama Public Radio, and Nash Jenkins of Time Magazine. He's in Washington. Great to have you all. Thanks so much. There were tense moments yesterday at the University of Florida. Was it a test of the First Amendment? We'll be right back with To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Alner here with today's talking point. The University of Florida obeyed its own rules yesterday and allowed white supremacist Richard Spencer to rent a hall and deliver a speech. The audience got to speak, too. Here's how it sounded.
Well, I'm not going home. So I think it's probably in your interest to sit down and allow me to speak, and then we'll have a conversation afterward. What do you think about that? You are all, each one of you, is at the preeminent, you are at the premier event for the question of free speech in this country. You all know that.
Angus Johnson is a professor at the City University of New York. He's a historian of student activism as well. Listen to that speech all the way through, or watched it. Angus Johnson, great to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Was it all that way the whole time?
It went on like that for a long time. He eventually had his sideman come up and talk a little bit, and then they took questions for a while. But he spent about 15 or 20 minutes complaining that he wasn't being allowed to speak while he was continuing to speak. It was kind of an odd display.
Anybody ask him a good question?
There was one question that I enjoyed, and somebody got up, a woman got up and asked him how it felt to be punched in the face. That was, I think, the high point for the discourse at that particular event.
Did he have any response to that?
He said it hurt. He said it hurts to be punched in the face.
So we got an honest answer from him on that one.
Yes. Yeah. And that was the thing. You know, a lot of folks came in with what they saw as gotcha questions, or what they saw as questions designed to reveal his bigotry. And he certainly did. He's a big fan of Hitler jokes and a big fan of talking about the ways in which, in his view, people of color are taking over what he considers to be white countries. But you know, giving him the opportunity to respond with his stump speech, essentially, was not particularly effective in revealing anything about him beyond what we already knew, in advancing any sort of a dialogue. You know, he's not a guy who has a hell of a lot to say.
He says this was an issue of free speech. Was it?
In a very, very narrow sense, it was. Here's the deal. So the University of Florida is a public institution. And if a public institution, a public college, has a policy that outside speakers are allowed to rent rooms without sponsorship from the university, then they have to admit anybody. Anybody who comes and wants to rent a room has to be allowed to. But they don't have to have that policy, and many colleges and universities don't. Texas A&M actually used to have that policy, and they got rid of it specifically because of Richard Spencer. So essentially, this is a debate about room reservation policies at public colleges and universities, which is a lot less exciting than the First Amendment knockdown dragout that a lot of people on both sides of the issue would like to frame it as.
Well, giving him a chance to speak letting the audience do what it did, everybody gets a chance. You said that nothing new, perhaps, was learned. But is this a model? Should other universities do the same thing? This has been an issue almost all across the country.
Well, I think that there is a very good case to be made to say that, unfortunately, this kind of shenanigans is a reason why colleges and universities should not have an all-comers policy. It's unfortunate because that's a policy that's good for the community. It's a policy that allows local people to have their knitting club meet on campus, local concert promoters to have a good place to put on a show. But the cost to the university for hosting somebody like Spencer is not just a cost to public discourse. It's a cost to their the way that they're seen in the community, the way that they're seen nationally. It's also an incredible financial cost. We're talking about more than $500,000 of state funding that went toward protecting him. So unfortunately, I think that the best choice out of a bunch of bad options is to deny him the platform. And forcing that bad choice is exactly what he wants, right? That what he's trying to do is create chaos. What he's trying to do is weaponize university policies and weaponize the openness of the university and the principles of free inquiry against the university itself.
That's a pretty high cost for the universities to pay, and the taxpayers again, if you can't have the knitting club and the other events that the buildings are now open for. Are they just going to sit there empty?
Yeah, and you're also going to lose revenue as well, right? If you allow a concert to be held, if you give people the opportunity to rent a room for a few hundred dollars, that's a sort of source of income for the university as well. But we saw over and over and over again yesterday, and we've seen over and over and over again over the last year, that whatever it is that allows these guys to make it onto campus, they are going to claim that this is a matter of academic freedom, that this is a matter of intellectual inquiry, that this is a matter of their First Amendment rights to speak on campus. And it's really about none of those things.
Why not? Why isn't it? Aren't campuses exactly the place where people are supposed to challenge other people's ideas?
Absolutely. But campuses are institutions and they are communities. And somebody like Richard Spencer has no connection to the campus as an institution or to the campus as a community. The point of the campus and free inquiry is not all comers, right? You don't have a right to just go in and walk into a classroom and start speaking about sociology if you're not the professor. You don't have a right to walk into a meeting of the Latin American Students Union and tell them what you think about that. You don't have a right to speak on campus if you're not a member of the campus community.
Well, that happens all the time, though. Are you going to deny politicians or great authors, Nobel Prize winners from Europe or people of that kind, opportunities to speak on campus?
Not if they're invited. An off-campus speaker is kind of like a vampire. They can't come in unless you invite them in the door. And I am absolutely a supporter of the rights of faculty, of administrators, of students to bring whoever they want onto the campus. But there was literally nobody on the University of Florida campus who was saying, I want to bring Richard Spencer and I'm going to lend my name to the project of bringing him to this campus.
Spencer wasn't invited, but as I understand, his group came up with $10,000 in order to get that room. That's probably a fair amount of money under the circumstances.
It is, although the Spencer and Yiannopoulos and a lot of these other folks have backers with very, very deep pockets, right? There is a constitutional ruling, a Supreme Court ruling, that says that you cannot dump all of the costs of your security onto a controversial speaker, because what's going to happen then is if somebody doesn't want somebody to come to campus, they will threaten a riot, then the price of security goes up, and then the person who has been invited to speak or has booked a room to speak no longer has the ability to speak. So the campus's hands are tied in that they are not able to pass the direct costs of security onto somebody like Richard Spencer. So as a result of that, they wind up losing a huge amount of money.
What about the media? There is a First Amendment protection for the free press as well as for the freedom of speech. Is there some way you can discipline the media not to cover stuff like this?
Well, I think that the issue there is he newsworthy? Is he a story? And I would say that unless he is actually speaking on a campus, he's not a particularly newsworthy person and doesn't get a huge amount of media attention. For me, though, I would say that the most important question when the media does wind up having to cover somebody like Spencer is to be very, very clear about these issues, including the ones that I've already raised, that he is not a First Amendment martyr, that this is not a matter of the university's prestige and imprimatur being placed behind him. This is essentially the equivalent of him booking a room at the Holiday Inn.
Do the students, do you think... are they entitled to coverage as well as he might be?
Absolutely. The story of student protest in this country right now is a very large one. There's a tremendous amount of student organizing that's going on against fascists in this country, a tremendous amount of activism, and a tremendous amount of pushback that students are getting, where their efforts to raise their own voices are being portrayed as being hostile to freedom of speech themselves, when I think that that's often not the case.
Angus Johnson, professor, City University of New York, historian of student activism. Great to have you on our show.
Thank you so much.
To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Yael, Evan Orr, and Evan Schwartz, technical director Mike Newport, managing producer Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.